Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jiabi Lee reporting. At least 5 people have been killed and another 36 wounded in a suicide bombing in Istanbul, Turkey. Dorian Jones reports.
Officials say the Saturday explosion happened on Istiklal Street, a wide boulevard usually full of shoppers and pedestrians at this time of the week. Turkey is already on high alert after recent bombings in the capital, Ankara, claimed by Kurdish rebels. And in the lead-up to the Kurdish Spring celebrations Monday, security forces are continuing a crackdown against the rebel Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, in towns and cities in the predominantly Kurdish southeast of Turkey. During a 2-year peace process between the government and the PKK that collapsed last year, Newroz became a public holiday as part of pro-Kurdish reforms. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
An airliner flying from Dubai has crashed while trying to land in the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don, killing all 62 people on board. Russia's emergencies ministry said the aircraft, a Boeing 737 operated by budget carrier Fly Dubai, crashed Saturday morning and most of those on board were Russian. The ministry's investigative committee said human error, bad weather, or technical failure may have contributed to the crash. The committee said both of the plane's flight recorders had been recovered undamaged. Russian President Vladimir Putin said providing assistance to the victims' families is a priority. The Dubai Media Office says the victims include 44 Russians, 8 Ukrainians, and more. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama will travel to Cuba Sunday for a historic visit as the two nations move to normalize relations 55 years after they broke off ties. White House correspondent Mary Lee Salinas has more.
Despite complaints by Havana, Obama will meet with Cuban dissidents. In a pinnacle moment, he will directly address the Cuban people, recalling a painful past and outlining a promising future. But the Republican-led Congress, which can lift the 55-year embargo on Cuba, is not convinced. To push his U.S.-Cuba policy beyond his final year in office, Obama needs bipartisan support. That's one reason why he is taking a delegation of both Democratic and Republican lawmakers. The White House says Obama's historic trip aims to make the normalization process between the two countries irreversible. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, The White House.
The Israeli military says its forces have shot and killed a Palestinian who attempted to attack Israeli soldiers on the occupied West Bank. The military says the assailant attacked the soldiers with a knife at Gush Etzion Junction, the location of several recent attacks on the Israeli military by Palestinians. The incident is the latest in a wave of violence since October that has killed at least 188 Palestinians, 28 Israelis, and 2 U.S. citizens. Israel has accused Palestinian leaders of inciting young people to riot. Palestinians deny this and say they are fed up with what they call Israeli oppression, little economic opportunity, and a dim outlook for peace. The top suspect in the terror attacks on Paris last year was discharged from a hospital in Brussels Saturday and will face official questioning and a fast-track extradition to Paris. After an emergency defense council meeting at the presidential palace in Paris, Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve called the capture of Salah Abdeslam on Friday an important blow to the terrorist organization Daesh in France. Cazeneuve said France will continue to equip law enforcement and keep security tight as the threat level remains extremely high, adding that France must maintain the vigilance in proportion to the threat level. Abdeslam and a suspected accomplice were injured when they were captured by police Friday. Sven Marie is Abdeslam's lawyer.
Well, I can tell you that he's collaborating with the Belgian justice and that we will refuse the extradition to France.
The International Police Agency, Interpol, urged European countries to be extra vigilant at their borders. 3 more astronauts are on the International Space Station Saturday, including Jeff Williams. I'm Jiabi Lee in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Part of our mandate in the Ministry of Environment is to look at environmental issues from the point of view of job creation, saving the environment and sustainable development.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari plans to launch a cleanup campaign in parts of the country affected by oil pollution.
During this election, it's true that some media outlets have tended to come out against the government. Because these are private media institutions. They are free to support whoever they want.
The Catholic Church in Zambia frowns on the intimidation and harassment of the media ahead of the August 11 general election.
If we had the chance to prevent that from happening in West Africa and other parts of continental Africa, wouldn't we want to do it? And now's the time to do it. Now's the time we have the opportunity to intervene against the Zika virus and subsequent microcephaly epidemic in other parts of West Africa besides Cape Verde.
And a global health expert sounds the alarm that an epidemic of Zika infections may be headed to West Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari plans to launch a massive cleanup campaign soon in the oil-rich Niger Delta region that has been adversely affected by oil pollution over the years. Alhaji Ibrahim Usman Jibril, Minister of State for Environment, says Buhari is committed to resolving the country's environmental challenges by creating two cabinet positions for the sector. Jibril told me Buhari tasked the two ministers to look at environmental issues with emphasis on job creation, saving the environment and ensuring sustainable development.
Part of our mandate in the Ministry of Environment is to look at environmental issues from the point of view of job creation, saving the environment and sustainable development. This is, in a nutshell, the mandate that we are to carry. In Nigeria, there are so many issues that are environmental in nature and deserve full attention of the government. Nigeria is a big country, and to the southern part of the country, you have issues pertaining to coastal erosion and the issue of climate change that is leading to sea level rise. This is a serious problem and is affecting a lot of the communities in the coastal areas. The mangroves are being destroyed through coastal erosion. Apart from that, there are issues of oil pollution. The mining sector or the oil industry in the Niger Delta area is having serious problems.
Some Nigerians have expressed concern, and you know this, that successive governments have particularly not gone after those who are behind, or they call them perpetrators of pollution. They mentioned some company names that have yet to be held accountable for polluting the environment. In this instance, being a cabinet minister for the environment, what is the policy direction on that?
The policy direction is quick intervention and doing the right thing at the right time. When the president took over about 9 months ago, the first point of call was the G7 meeting where he was invited in Berlin. And there and then he made a pronouncement that the Niger Delta cleanup will start in earnest. Don't forget, during his campaign, he promised the people of Ogoniland, when he went there to campaign, that he is going to take the issue of cleaning the Ogoniland very, very seriously. He followed it up in Germany, and about a month ago when he went to the United Nations Environment Programme in Kenya, he reiterated that promise. It is our duty as ministers to fulfill those obligations and the promises made by the president. And I can assure you, we're doing just that. 2 weeks ago, we were in Rivers and Bayelsa to start the sensitization campaign. We met with the two governors. We met with the Ogoni people, the Mosol, the Kagote. All these are people that are concerned about the environment, and they have been agitating for a very long time since the oil spill started. So what we are doing now is to strengthen the organs like NOSRA, which is a regulatory agency that is charged with controlling oil spillage and remedying it. The president, we hope, in a couple of weeks, will launch the Goni cleanup and subsequently the entire Niger Delta. Don't forget, this pollution has been going on for more than 40 years. And it is a program that will start and will go on probably for the next 20 years.
But will the people on the ground mostly affected by these pollution activities be involved or talked to or consulted to enable the government to be efficient in this direction to clean up those polluted areas?
Yes, they are. Don't forget, I mentioned the United Nations Environment Report.
Right, in 2007.
Yeah, it was the government of Nigeria that asked UNEP to do a study and produce that report. They did it, they submitted a report, and they recommended the polluter pay principle where those involved or those responsible for causing the pollution will have to pay for the cleaning. What we are concerned now is that the companies will have to pay, and there is money left kept aside for that as recommended by UNEP report. And fortunately for us, this UNEP report is seen as a gospel in the Niger Delta. We are starting with Ogoni land because it is the area that first gained prominence in issue of this pollution. And then we'll move it to other parts of the Niger Delta that are equally or even more seriously polluted. That's why I said earlier we had to travel to see the governor of Rivers and the governor of Bayelsa to tell them that this is our intention. And don't forget, I told you, we met with the Mosop people in Bori, their headquarters, and we had a chat with them in their town hall meeting to tell the people that we are about to start this cleaning up, and you have to key in to support the government, to support the idea so that we can start the cleaning in earnest. One thing is clear. We need to start the cleaning, and we will do that by the grace of God. But what happens after the cleaning?
I was going to ask you
about the day after the cleaning is important. We want a situation where once this cleaning is started, it has to stay clean. There are third-party agents that are involved in this oil spillage. But where the company is responsible, where any oil company is responsible, the government will hold them responsible and ensure that they pay for the cleaning.
Alhaji Ibrahim Usman Jibril is the Nigerian Minister of State for Environment. He spoke with me from here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. The Catholic Church in Zambia has called on political parties and their supporters to stop harassing and intimidating journalists as the August 11 general election approaches. In a press statement, Father Winfield Kunda, Communications Director for Catholic Media Services, says it's regrettable that supporters of political parties will engage in acts of violence and intimidation of the media. Kunda told me that the church would not condone threat and intimidation of the media.
And this warning has just arrived as a result of, you might have heard that there is a community radio station that has decided to shut down from broadcasting because of the threat from the supporters of the government who felt disgruntled or disappointed that that community radio station was becoming anti-government. Now, the way they reported it was like the Catholic Church owns that radio station. Apparently, we do not own that radio station. That radio station is just a community radio station right in Kasama. So we took cognizance of the fact that the media has to be left free. And that's why we published this statement to indicate to our politicians and especially political parties to discourage their cadres from attacking media workers. Particularly during this time, it is very common that the media seems to be polarized.
Yeah, talking about polarization of the media, party supporters have often accused one radio station or one newspaper or one media organization or the other of showing bias to the government or against the government. How do you address such a concern, Father Kunda?
During these elections, yeah, it's true that some media outlets have tended to come out against the government. And what we have decided to as the church is to all the best to appeal to them, because these are private media institutions. They are free to support whoever they want, but that they should remain ethical and that they should remain factual as they report in whatever they are going to report, and not to be sensational or just to accuse. Of course, there have been some media houses which have been labeled as those which are anti-government.
Now, I heard from Father Bwalya that he has been attacked at Monzi FM, Sky FM. Your statement dovetails into these attacks. What is your reaction to this attack? If a ruling party official could be attacked while he was at a radio station, then Zambians should feel concerned about this.
Yes, Zambia should be feel concerned about it. But personally, coming from the Catholic Church, my appeal is to the police. By and large, all these media houses are supposed to be protected by the police. All media houses, whether they are public or private or communal, are supposed to be protected by the police. So whenever we have a topic issue or they are inviting a guest, whom they know that maybe in that community is not most welcome, the owners of the radio stations, the managers and what, they have to inform the police so that the guests are protected, as well as the equipment and the infrastructure is protected. This is an appeal we always make to all radio stations during this time when we are going to have elections.
Father Kunda, in your anticipated meeting with all the political leaders and perhaps the political parties, will there also be a meeting with these media professionals, with the political parties, to try to ease possible tension ahead of the election because of some of these occurrences that you've enumerated about tension being high, about accusation of bias, among other concerns?
Although it wasn't highlighted as like the way I've put it, but I suppose during the meetings, one of the issues that will be highlighted is the media coverage. Because, you know, in our constitution, even in our electoral code of conduct, all media institutions, be it private or public, have been tasked to remain unbiased as they report. So that will be, I hope, will be also noted so that will be discussed. But as we have alluded to, it's just that during this time, the media seems to be polarized. And you can even see it, that those who are against a certain party or political party, in the way they do their reporting, it's just that they are against that political party.
Father Winfield Kunda is the Communications Director for Catholic Media Services. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The African Leadership University, or ALU, is a newly established tertiary institution offering programs aimed at developing Africa's future leaders. It's been launched this week with a grand opening ceremony at its flagship campus on the Indian island nation of Mauritius. It aims at producing 3 million African leaders in the next 5 decades, distinguishing itself as the premier institution for leadership education. Fred Swaniker is the founder of the new Institution of Higher Learning. For VOA reporter Ruben Chiama asked him to explain how different it is from the African Leadership Academy in South Africa.
African Leadership Academy in South Africa and African Leadership University, the network of universities we're building across Africa, are both institutions that I founded as Fred Swaniker and together with other partners. And we have built them with the same ethos, which is to identify and develop the most outstanding young talent in Africa into the next generation of leaders. Where the two institutions are different is that the academy is a pre-university program, the last 2 years of high school, which also emphasizes leadership and entrepreneurial training. But the destination of graduates from the African Leadership Academy is to universities which primarily have been outside of Africa to date. African Leadership University is a university. And so we admit students after they've finished high school, and we give them degrees, but also train them as entrepreneurs and leaders. And then we're also offering master's level programs, and we're offering, for example, the first Pan-African MBA program ever. And the destination of the graduates from the university is employment. They're going into jobs, they're creating their own jobs as entrepreneurs, they're becoming, academics and so forth. So that's really, really the difference. And then final difference is the scale. African Leadership Academy, we have about 125 students a year that we admit in a two-year program, so roughly 250 students at a time. The university, we're planning to have 250,000 students at a time, so it's 1,000 times bigger than the academy.
What are your next steps, your personal vision? From here, where do we go?
Well, we've just begun a very long journey. So for me, the next step is to keep going and to, expand Mauritius. First, to 1,000 students by next year, and then 7,000 students in the next few years. And then, we'll explore opening campuses in Nigeria and Rwanda, and then we'll go from there. So, I take this one step at a time, one day at a time, and think about what our short-term priorities in the next 3 months, and then make sure that we deliver on those, and that builds on for us to do the next. And then before we know it, 15, 20 years from now, we'll have a network of universities around Africa. But for now, we're just focusing on growing Mauritius.
Where do you draw your inspiration from?
For me, I am passionately in love with Africa. And so when you love something, you want to see that thing prosper and flourish and be great. And unless we take development into our own hands and create our own wealth, we will never get the respect that we deserve as Africans. And we can't stop waiting for other people to develop us. We have to develop ourselves. And the only way we develop ourselves is not by continuing to dig up our oil and gold and timber and whatever. It's by developing our brains.
Fred Swanika is the founder of the African Leadership University. He spoke with Ruben Chioma in Port Louis, Mauritius. The militaries of Cameroon and Nigeria have freed hundreds of hostages held by Boko Haram, including dozens of girls and women either forcefully married or held as sex slaves. They were freed after raids on the town of Ashigashiya that straddles Cameroon and Nigeria. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kanzika met the teenage girls and women who recounted their experiences.
Speaking in Kanuri, a language spoken in northern Cameroon and northeastern Nigeria, Aisha Musa says after she was asked by her parents to get married at the age of 14 last year, her husband took her to the Sambisa Forest, a stronghold of Boko Haram situated on the Cameroon-Nigeria border.
One day, okay.
She says while there, her husband led a group of motorcycle riders that transported Boko Haram fighters to steal, kidnap and kill in cattle ranches, farms and markets, both in Cameroon and Nigeria. She says in the forest, there were so many girls, some younger than her, who served as sex slaves for unmarried Boko Haram fighters. She says after 1 year in the forest, her husband said their living conditions were getting worse and their lives were threatened by frequent raids by the military. She says they decided to escape and the opportunity came when Cameroon and Nigerian forces attacked and they surrendered to the troops. Aisha regrets that after they were freed, Cameroon's military took her husband to an unknown destination and asked that she be transported to the Minawawa refugee camp in northern Cameroon. 42-year-old Shakira Habiba says she was forced out of her marital home in Ashigashiya along with dozens of women and girls by 15 heavily armed men. She says she spent 10 and a half months with Boko Haram fighters in a bush area she cannot identify. Habiba says while there, she was buried up to her waist for 20 days as punishment for being a Christian. She says she was later given as the first wife to a Boko Haram Muslim. Habiba, who arrived at the Minawawa refugee camp with a three-month-old baby, says there were hundreds of Cameroon and Nigerian girls in the Boko Haram hideout doing household chores and used for sex by the fighters. She says those who became pregnant are handed over to traditional birth attendants. In 2013, Nigeria reported that Boko Haram had stepped up kidnappings of young women to sell them into sexual slavery or force them to marry its fighters. The tactics attracted international outrage, but efforts to prevent more kidnappings or rescue the young girls were not successful. The hundreds of school children kidnapped from a Nigerian school in Chibok have not been found. The practice spread to Cameroon in 2014 when the military announced a number of young girls on its border with Nigeria had been taken for marriage by Boko Haram fighters. Lieutenant Colonel Felix Techa, one of Cameroon's senior military officers fighting the insurgency, says Boko Haram again engaged in the practice after its ability to fight was weakened by raids the military organized on Boko Haram strongholds since last December.
Boko Haram, notre ennemi, semble désormais privilégier les actions à fort impact.
He says the enemy, Boko Haram, now prefers to psychologically torment the population. He says Boko Haram's decision to kidnap and rape women and children indicates a return to a more dreaded asymmetric war. Cameroon says it is handing over the teenage girls and women to specialized United Nations agencies for psychological care. The United Nations says Boko Haram's six-year insurgency has killed more than 20,000 people and displaced more than 2.5 million. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A global health expert is sounding the alarm that an epidemic of Zika infections may be headed to West Africa in countries ravaged over the past 2 years by Ebola. He says efforts to contain Zika are essential to head off another devastating public health emergency on the continent. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
This week, a baby in Cape Verde, a Portuguese-speaking island off the northwestern coast of Africa, was born with the neurological defect microcephaly, a small head due to an undeveloped brain. Tests are still pending to see whether the birth defect was caused by Zika virus, a pathogen carried by mosquitoes. The disease has infected dozens of pregnant women in South America, mostly in Brazil, who've given birth to babies with microcephaly. The condition causes stillbirth or, if the baby lives, severe neurological complications. Daniel Lucy, an infectious diseases specialist at Georgetown University in Washington, fears the case of microcephaly in Cape Verde could be a sign of things to come in Western Africa. He's calling for strong and immediate preventive measures.
If we had the chance to prevent that from happening in West Africa and other parts of continental Africa, wouldn't we want to do it? And now's the time to do it. Now's the time we have the opportunity to intervene against the Zika virus and subsequent microcephaly epidemics in other parts of West Africa besides Cape Verde.
Lucy is particularly worried about the impact of Zika in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, countries that were the epicenter of the Ebola epidemic. Thousands died from the highly infectious disease as the developing nations tried desperately to cope with new cases. The symptoms of Zika, which are relatively mild, could be mistaken for the early signs of Ebola, which Lucy worries could overtax medical resources as health workers try to determine what disease they were facing. Lucy sounded the warning in a commentary published in the journal Health Security. The World Health Organization is considering some dramatic experimental methods of mosquito control. They include releasing sterile mosquitoes into the wild so the insects can't reproduce, and setting out swarms of Aegypti mosquitoes infected with the bacteria Wolbachia.
The concept, as I understand, is that mosquitoes that are infected with the Wolbachia bacteria are much less likely to then be infectable with viruses like the Zika virus. and therefore they're not going to be able to transmit the Zika virus to people, to us, to our species, to human beings.
Meanwhile, computer modeling conducted by the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research concludes that warmer weather conditions in the United States could attract Aegypti mosquitoes, possibly bringing the threat of Zika to an estimated 50 U.S. cities. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our African collection. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Tuana miro miro, nange miro miro, Tuana miro miro, nange miro miro. You know, I enjoy your presence, you know, ay. Miro, ya, my baby, you take me so high. Oh, yeah, Simbarara, you make me dance, kumbaya, mira. Baby, you turn down the soda. You swag and shake in your shoulder. And you know, I enjoy your presence, you know. Ay, 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 ay. Go by one and for the sun, you go by one and see the magic. Oh, yeah.
Baby, care. Baby super, nasi tima ye guanjakira. Baby care, baby super, awaka bitu niringala.
Yo yo, runja chirenku.
Yo yo,
gondanga kapiro.
Yo yo,
untuana miro miro.
Watao,
nange miro miro.
Watao,
runja chirenku.
Yo yo,
gondanga kapiro.
Yo yo,
untuana miro miro.
Watao,
nange miro miro.
Watao,
ya ya ya, my baby you take me so high. Simbarara, you make me dance, kumbaya, nera.
You're my woman song, sweet in my soldier. You're my woman song, heater in the winter.
Watao,
dangerous.
Watao,
and the kings are dangerous.
Watao.
Yeah. You were dangerous. Salman Hussein.
Yeah, kacha gukusaba umutima wache ba kumpiti teka kunia ochi sembeza kunia era babu babu gamba teka kunia baby tanyo mamutima Onda sori wachia, onda sento ya gala na chita, onda sento ya gala kuyamba, onda sori watima, baby wafuka mashamu, erota mbola na bachamu, ebintu yobikabira bachamu, baby katiyo wane bachamu.
Jayo sanga suwe, sanga singe, nyagalo kilise, sanga singe,
jagalo nyantule, chipala singe.
La femme de mon patron est tombée amoureuse de moi. Elle m'a proposé de devenir son amant. Elle est riche et elle est belle, mais moi je ne veux pas de problème. Son mari c'est mon directeur, moi je suis son chauffeur. Si je deviens l'amant de la femme du patron, c'est dangereux. Diabolique, malgré leur beauté angélique, quand une femme est amoureuse, elle devient très dangereuse. La femme du patron m'a dit si je refuse, elle ira dire à son mari que c'est moi qui lui fais la cour. Même si je suis innocent, j'aurai de gros ennuis. Situation, je ne trouve pas de solution, car dans cette affaire, moi je ne sais plus que faire. Puis dans tous les cas, je n'ai pas tellement le choix. Si je dis oui, c'est imprudent à cause du patron. Mais si je dis non à la femme, elle va se venger. Que faut-il dire? Oh, que faut-il dire? Koutoubouye. Si je dis oui, j'ai peur du patron. Kamakouye. Mais si je dis non, la femme va se venger. Koutoubouye. Ah, quelle affaire! Ah, quelle histoire! Que faut-il faire? Que faut-il dire? Si je dis oui, si je dis non. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire! Que faut-il dire? Oh, que faut-il dire? Que tout bouille. Si je dis oui, j'ai peur du patron. Kabakouye. Mais si je dis non, la femme va se venger. Que tout bouille. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire! Que faut-il dire? Que faut-il faire? Si je dis oui, si je dis non. Ah, quelle histoire! Ah, quelle affaire!
so eko tindanga na mela poisson. Soki na kufi bandeko, koka mwate, sela nanga ya komoi, eke ibamba. Motema moto moto, mabala ya bomwana, ele ki makambo, pampa sina komona, nale miko botela. Motema mpe mabanzo, name kako peta mokongo, name mingambo, mabala ya bomwana, ele ki makambo. Motema mpe mabanzo, mabanzo eko tindanga na mela poisson.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Shaogang Chang. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, one must have to wait till the evening of one's lifetime to know what gratitude to pay to one's guardian spirit. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kiremt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in five decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do two things: avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.